47 years ago, it is perhaps the most famous phrase in the English language, and certainly the most celebrated in America. On November 19, 1863, President Lincoln attended the dedication of a cemetery for Union soldiers who several months before had fought at Gettysburg on July 1st through July 3rd, the most terrible battle in the Civil War. The central attraction for the dedication ceremony was Edward Everett, one of the most celebrated orators in America, who spoke at this event for several hours and whose words have been largely forgotten. Lincoln, meanwhile, delivered brief but immortal remarks known to this day. The Gettysburg Address, the first half of which described the essence of the American founding and explained that the war was being fought to preserve and advance all that America embodies, and that what America embodied could be found in the words of the Declaration of Independence that had been approved by the Continental Congress 87 years before. But Lincoln at Gettysburg did not say 87 years before. Instead, he uttered a phrase that utilizes the word score, referring to 20 years. So 80 is 80. 87 is 87. That's the most math you're going to have in this presentation. And this is how he began. 87 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. These words have been studied, pored over, discussed, and debated for generations. Today, we engage them again, but in an unusual way, and that is to join the story of Abraham Lincoln, the most famous American in our country's history, with that of a rabbi whose name has been largely forgotten, even among American Jewry, the community to whom he once ministered. We analyze the Gettysburg Address by telling the tale of Rabbi Sabato Moraes, and we begin by describing his biography, drawing on the excellent account of Rabbi Dr. Alan Corey. We then turn to one specific sermon of Moraes, which will allow us to then conclude with an analysis and a deeper understanding of the Gettysburg Address. Sabato Moraes, I'm quoting Alan Corey, was born in Leghorn, Italy, in 1823 to a family of Sephardic Portuguese Jewish descent, the third of nine children and the oldest son. His native language was Italian, and he acquired also a good knowledge of Spanish and French early in life. He was a favorite pupil of Avram Baruch Piperno, one of the Jewish sages of Leghorn, and at the age of 22, he was an applicant for the post of Chazan, or cantor, to the Sephardic congregation of London. But, we are further informed by Corey, the young Moraes was unsuccessful in this position since his lack of English told against him. Now keep Moraes' English in mind, for it will be important in the next part of our story. Soon another opportunity arose, this time in the New World. Mikveh Israel, the Sephardic Spanish-Portuguese community in Philadelphia, had since the 1820s been led by Isaac Leeser, the most prominent intellectual in the American Jewish world. Why then did Leeser leave? Why did the position open? You will have trouble even conceiving the possibility of what I'm about to describe, and that is that an argument broke out between the clerical leader of the synagogue and the lay leadership over his contract. Now I know you are shocked. But if you can summon the will to calm yourselves at your surprise, I will explain. As one version has it, by 1849, quote, Leeser had demanded a lifetime contract, a larger salary, and greater authority in the congregation. He had also, historians report, antagonized many members of the congregation. And so, as often happens to poor rabbis like Moraes, who enter a synagogue after something like this occurs, Moraes comes into a congregation that was ultimately split. It was split between critics of Leeser and those who still remained loyal to Leeser and were upset that he had left. Moraes' job as minister of the congregation was to both lead the services and to preach, but Moraes was well aware of the fact that the community appreciated one of these tasks more than the other. As he wrote, during 9 months of the year, I give weekly instruction from this pulpit. That's sermons. When the summer season begins, I generally cease speaking in the vernacular and confine myself to the reading of the established ritual. That means chazanut. And then he continued, that some would prefer my following the last named course at all times, I have reason to believe, meaning to follow the summer course of not speaking at all. Why would Moraes say this? Why would people not like his sermons? Now, there is, of course, the fact that English was not his native language. But there is another factor that many of his congregants may have disliked about some of his sermons, and that is that Moraes was a man of principle and of political beliefs, who often put his principles and political beliefs above his professional well-being. This was first manifest in 1858, during what was known the world over as the Mortara affair, when Edgardo Mortara, a Jewish child of the Sephardic community of Bologna, which was then part of the Papal States, was taken from his home to be raised as a Catholic because his nurse had claimed that she had baptized him when he was ill. News of Mortara's abduction galvanized the Jewish world into action, and the Jews in America appealed to their president at the time, James Buchanan, otherwise known as the worst president in the history of the United States. And Buchanan responded that this was a matter involving foreign nationals and he was not going to get involved. Now, Moraes was undoubtedly doubly offended by this. First, as a Sephardic Jew of Italian origin, this was extremely personal to him. But second, Moraes had fallen in love with his new country precisely because he believed that it stood for something larger, for a universal doctrine of human rights, one which he felt that President Buchanan had failed. And so, and here I'm quoting Corre's account, on the next Sabbath, when the point in the service was reached when the traditional prayer was recited for the president, Moraes pointedly omitted it. Apparently, he felt that a president who would not stand up for civil rights was not worth praying for. The congregation, writes Corre, was scandalized. The adjunta, that's a Spanish word referring to the lay leadership of the congregation. The adjunta, as the governing body of the synagogue is still called, met the very next day and demanded that he restore the prayer for the government. On December 2nd, 1858, one of the lay leaders of the congregation wrote him a letter that was marked strictly private and alluded to, quote, your refusal to recite the prayer for the members of the government as you have hitherto done. This lay leader then added the following, quote, you are aware that the adjunta could suspend you from office, which would only be a step to discharge. You know that the board can command a majority to any measure their wisdom may induce them to think correct. Are you prepared, he wrote, to be hurled from a position of pecuniary independence to one of unrequited labor in which you might find it difficult to earn a pittance? End quote. Or, to translate this man's eloquence into a more modern parlance, that's a nice rabbinic position you've got there. It would be a shame if something happened to it. Then, in 1861, Buchanan was replaced by a man who was infinitely more to Moraes' liking, Abraham Lincoln. Moraes' affection for Lincoln can be seen in a poignant prayer that he delivered in 1862 upon the death in the White House of Lincoln's son, Willie. Here, Moraes did pray for the president, and with love, and he said as follows. Bless the President of the United States. Bless him for his sterling honesty. Bless him for his firmness and moderation. Rekindle with joy his domestic hearth. Pour on him the balm of divine consolation. Grant that the end of his career be the maintenance of this government, unimpaired and unsullied as bequeathed by our illustrious ancestors. This was his prayer. And Moraes' words were sent by a synagogue representative to Lincoln, who responded, quote, "Thank you heartily for your expressions of kindness and confidence." And this is, by the way, the only known letter sent by Lincoln to a synagogue in America. But Moraes' trouble with his laity were only beginning. For during the war, he emerged as a full-fledged Republican and opponent of slavery. Many members of the community, on the other hand, were Northern Democrats, for whom Lincoln had to be replaced and the Southern demands accommodated in order for the Civil War to cease. People of this political persuasion, Northern Democrats, were known as Copperheads. This was originally an insult thrown at them by Republicans, who were referring to the American species of a venomous snake, but these Northern Democrats ultimately embraced the term and wore a copper penny in their lapels with the head of Liberty. The differences, moral, philosophical, and political, between Moraes and members of his congregation came to a head when on November 1st, 1864, Maryland joined with the Union, but up to this point a slave state, voted to forever ban the practice of slavery. Soon after, Moraes delivered a drasha, a sermon, celebrating this decision. Therein he said as follows, and I quote, "Not the victories of the Union, but those of freedom, my friends, do we celebrate. What is union with human degradation? Who would again affix his seal to the bond that consigned millions? Not I, the enfranchised slave of Mitzrayim. Not you, whose motto is progress and civilization. Cast then," he said, "your vision yonder, and behold the happy change wrought by the hand of Providence." And then, indulging in the rabbinic predilection for puns, he said, quote, "Thy name shall no longer be called Maryland, but Maryland. For thou hast," see, it's a tough crowd, rabbis don't get. Okay. "But Maryland, for thou hast verily breathed a joyous spirit into the souls of all thy inhabitants." That was his sermon. Now, in response to this political sermon, the leadership of the congregation did the unthinkable, something so cruel, so beyond the pale, that this very notion will horrify, no doubt, all of you. They banned the rabbi from giving sermons for several months. Oh, the humanity. As Corre reports, the Synagogue ad Junta would brook no reference to this issue, which had the country bitterly divided, and decreed that henceforth all English lectures or discourses be dispensed with, except by particular agreement of the Parnas, that's the president, made in writing. And despite Moraes' protests, the gag rule held for about 2 months. Then some members petitioned the board, and on February 5th, 1865, the board voted that the Reverend S. Moraes deliver a religious discourse. As Corre points out, the word religious is underlined, meaning that he has to stay away from politics, on one Sabbath of each month, meaning he can only speak once a month, and only about religion and any holiday. And then immediately before the Passover that year, Moraes wrote, quote, "I would now respectfully ask that you allow me to address the congregation whenever I deem fit." That's Moraes many years after he already entered this position. Now, what is fascinating, ladies and gentlemen, is that we have a small comment by Moraes himself about this incident. And the reason why we know of this comment is itself essential to be understood by all of you for the purpose of our lecture. A Victorian habit that Moraes must have picked up in Europe was keeping a scrapbook wherein he would paste all of his printed and published sermons and Divrei Torah. Now, historians who had studied Moraes learned of this scrapbook but couldn't find it. It was lost. This was sad, because Moraes was wont to write notes on some of his printed speeches, which lent a larger historical context. As one dissertation on Moraes put it, from the few jottings we have seen in Moraes' handwriting on his text, quote, we can only begin to surmise how much valuable information has been lost. Enter a South New Jersey businessman by the name of Marvin Wiener. Wiener, as his son recounts, quote, had a method to his collecting. Whenever one of his pamphlets or books mentioned another pamphlet, book, correspondence, or newspaper article, he tried to acquire it, meaning Wiener is a collector, collects historical books. Whenever there was a philosophical work which underpinned the ideas of the American Revolution, Marvin Wiener tried to obtain a first or early edition of it. He had the idea that he would try to duplicate the library of Thomas Jefferson and use it as his guide. He thrilled at the notion of holding in his hands the same material that was read by the founding fathers. Then, one day in the 1950s, Marvin Wiener was perusing a junk store in West Philadelphia called Sam Kleinman's Schuylkill Bookshop, and he came upon a large ledger which turned out to be Moraes' scrapbook. This is one of the great random or providential discoveries of American Jewish history and is now kept at the Katz Center in Philadelphia. I have held it, and there pasted to one of the pages is a printed version of this Maryland sermon. This sermon, like many others, had been published, and Moraes had kept the clippings. And on this sermon, as I read in the ledger, Moraes wrote a little note. And you all have it in front of you. This is page one of your handout. What you see on the top is the Maryland sermon, pasted, which you're not going to read, it's okay. But then you see on the bottom right, we have some handwriting in pencil. That's Moraes' handwriting. I pick up from where the arrow is. Moraes wrote, a history is connected with it. Copperheads became so enraged by reason of it that I got a hornet's nest around my ears. Men would have stopped my speaking altogether, but I appealed to my constituents, and after 3 months' silence, renewed my free speech as formerly. That's Moraes' own note about his Maryland speech in his scrapbook. We have now set the stage for our central subject, which is a sermon that is also found in this scrapbook, 1 year before the Maryland sermon. On Saturday, the 4th of July, 1863, Rabbi Moraes ascended the pulpit to deliver the Sabbath sermon. Now remember, as Moraes himself recounted, he didn't usually deliver sermons during the summer months. But today was different. In advance of July 4th, the anniversary of American independence, the Philadelphia Union League, a Republican organization dedicated to supporting Lincoln and his policies, had requested of Philadelphia clergy that celebratory sermons be preached throughout the city on July 4th weekend, utilizing as their unified theme, this was the request, the verse from Leviticus that was emblazoned on the celebrated bell that sat in that very same city. Proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. So this is why Moraes gave a summer sermon. But again, as was his wont, Rabbi Moraes did not in his sermon do what he had been asked to do. He did not give a celebratory discussion of Independence Day. And this for several reasons. First, while that Shabbat was indeed the 4th of July, it was also in the Jewish calendar the 17th of Tammuz, one of the seven saddest days of the Jewish year, on which the Romans breached the walls of Jerusalem and entered the city. This day marked a three-week mourning period for the Jewish people, and therefore an entirely celebratory sermon appeared inappropriate. But there was another, more pressing reason, originally unforeseen by the Union League, as to why Moraes felt a more somber sermon was required. Over the past 3 days, July 1st through July 3rd, Union and Confederate forces had been engaged in an epic battle south of the city in Pennsylvania at Gettysburg. And Moraes knew on Shabbat the 4th that the battle had been going on, but he had no idea who had won. Whether the Union had won or the Confederacy. And if the Confederate forces had won, if General Lee had won, then Lee could continue onward to Philadelphia itself. And so, Morea said in this sermon that he could not speak in a joyous mood. "Can it be reasonably expected," he said, "that I should expatiate upon a joyful theme? Can I delineate," he said, "in glowing characters, the happiness and glory derived for a period from the declaration that the colonial states and sundered apart the bonds of dependence, when the effects of a long thraldom and a fraternal strife stare me in the face? No," he said, "the times do not warrant it. The melancholy occurrences that befell us, my brothers and sisters in faith, at this season direct my thoughts to a gloomy throughout." Thus, instead of focusing on American independence, Morea spoke of what had occurred millennia earlier in the Holy Land, and he compared biblical Jerusalem to his own city of Philadelphia, and he asked that the fate that befell the former not occur to the latter. But, though he was indeed somber throughout, there was one remarkable passage in the speech wherein he assured his audience that he had not forgotten the joyous date on which he spoke, that he could not forget that the Declaration of Independence had been approved 87 years ago to that day, nor could he forget that Mikveh Israel was just down the block from Independence Hall, where that glorious event had originally occurred. And so he said as follows, and you could see this in the scrapbook, and this is page 2 in your handout. I have circled this line. You could see it around a third of the way down. Everybody there? This is in his scrapbook. And he says as follows, "I am not indifferent." Everybody focus very carefully. "I am not indifferent, my dear friends, to the event which 47 years ago brought to this new world light and joy. I yield to none in feelings of deep reverence for the sages and patriots that labored for its consummation, the principles enunciated in the document unfolded and first read in yonder hall command still my highest admiration." So note the phrase, 47 years ago. As one scholar of homiletics, Mark Saperstein, has noted, in the mid-19th century, few Americans spoke in this manner. They did not say 80. They said 80. Moraes, however, did speak this way. He spoke this way naturally. He spoke this way all the time. Why? Recall, as we mentioned, that he was not a native English speaker. And as one of the great scholars of Moraes and his life explained to me, Arthur Kidron, explained it to me as we were examining this speech in the original scrapbook. Moraes had taught himself English by comparing the Hebrew text of the Tanakh, which of course he knew, to the English text that, though old-fashioned, was the one text with which almost all Americans were familiar, and that is the King James Bible. That is how he taught himself English, utilizing the King James Bible. 80 is a King James Bible word, perhaps most famously found in Psalms 90 in the King James translation. Yimei shenoteinu bahem shivim shana, ve'im bikvurot shmonim shana. The days of our years are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80 years. Now, of course, in Hebrew, we don't say 80. We say shmonim, which means 80. Okay, but in the English of the King James Bible, it's 80. 80 is the word for 80 in the King James, the Bible used by most Americans at the time. But for most Americans at the time, this word was one reserved for the Bible. No one in America spoke this way off the cuff. And by no one in America, I include Abraham Lincoln, who also, soon after the Battle of Gettysburg, delivered some brief off-the-cuff reflections. For Lincoln, in contrast to Moraes, the 4th of July, 1863, had been largely a good one, because, of course, he knew on that day who had won at Gettysburg. But he also knew of another critical victory that occurred on the 4th of July itself, but on the other side of the country. The critical fortress of Vicksburg, surrounded and besieged by a then obscure Union officer by the name of Ulysses S. Grant, had also surrendered on that day. Indeed, the general who was commanding the Confederate forces in the fortress, whose name I believe was John C. Pembroke, was actually from the North, but he joined the South because his wife was from the South. And he said to his forces, "I am a Northern man. I know my countrymen. They will give us better terms on the 4th of July." And so they surrendered on the 4th of July. So Lincoln had a very good 4th of July. Then on July 7th, a crowd and a band had gathered at the White House. And speaking to them, Lincoln reflected as follows. Listen carefully. He said, "How long ago is it, 80-odd years, since on the 4th of July, for the first time in the history of the world, a nation by its representatives assembled and declared as a self-evident truth that all men are created equal. And now," he said, "on this last 4th of July just passed, when we have a gigantic rebellion, at the bottom of which is an effort to overthrow the principle that all men are created equal, we have the surrender of a most powerful position and army on that very day, that's Vicksburg. And not only so," he continued, "but in a succession of battles in Pennsylvania, near to us," that's Gettysburg, "through 3 days, so rapidly fought that they might be called one great battle on the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of the month of July. And on the 4th, the cohorts of those who opposed the declaration that all men are created equal turned tail and ran. Gentlemen," he said, "this is a glorious theme and the occasion for a speech, but I am not prepared to make one worthy of the occasion." Those are his words, July 7th, 1863. What we see in these impromptu words is the roots of the Gettysburg Address. Lincoln is pondering the significance of the fact that these great victories in the Civil War occurred on the 4th of July, and that the war was, as he saw it, being fought for the very doctrine declared on the first 4th of July, that all men were created equal. This, he says, is a glorious theme for a speech. And indeed, it ultimately became the theme for one of the most extraordinary speeches in American history. So in these impromptu remarks, the kernel of the Gettysburg Address is here. But one phrase he does not use is 67 years ago, because people did not speak this way. Lincoln referred to 1776 as 80-odd years ago. But several months later, when he actually spoke at Gettysburg, his language had changed. 67 years ago. Could Lincoln have been inspired by Moraes' sermon? Well, we do know, as seen in the scrapbook, that this sermon was published. We do know that previously Moraes' words had been sent to Lincoln. There is at least a strong possibility that this could have been seen by Lincoln as well. The historian Jonathan Sarna, asked about it in an interview, said the following: "We do know that some of Moraes' sermons were sent to Lincoln and that he read them. Good politicians are known for borrowing phrases that will resonate with the public. So it is possible. All we know for sure," he said, "is that Moraes used the phrase before Lincoln and that the president had read some of Moraes' sermons." So we cannot know for sure whether or not Lincoln took the words 67 years ago from Moraes. But if not, the coincidence is uncanny. And either way, the story of Moraes' sermon sheds light on the Gettysburg Address. Moraes spoke this way because he learned English from the King James Bible. If Lincoln did not speak this way naturally, but chose to begin his address with the words 67 years ago, it was because he wished for the Gettysburg Address to take on a biblical tone in the ears of Americans. This was not the first time he had done this. And one of the most interesting earlier examples took place right near Moraes' synagogue, at a location to which Moraes referred in his sermon. In 1861, on the way to his inauguration, Lincoln visited Philadelphia's Independence Hall. And he said, referring to the hall, the following: "I have never asked anything that does not breathe from those walls. All my political warfare has been in favor of the teachings coming forth from that sacred hall. May my right hand forget its cunning, and my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If ever I prove false, to those teachings. He then broke a glass. No, he didn't do that. Okay. So here, too, a reference to the Psalms is made. Independence Hall and Lincoln's rhetoric is America's Jerusalem. The Declaration, the creed that all men are created equal, was America's covenant. And if 2 years later, at Gettysburg, Lincoln invokes English that for most of America sounds biblical, and he recounts the founding that took place 47 years ago, dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, it is because Lincoln is seeking to achieve a biblically inspired moment of covenantal remembrance and restoration. Many miss this. One of the most famous books about Gettysburg is Gary Will's Lincoln at Gettysburg, which advances the thesis that Lincoln's remarks at Gettysburg were inspired by the rhetoric of classical Greece. But as the New Yorker's Adam Gopnik points out, it is the two-hour speech that preceded Lincoln's, that of Edward Everett, that was classical in tone. Everett talked about Marathon and the Greeks and the Persian invasion and compared Gettysburg soldiers to them. But Lincoln's rhetoric, Gopnik writes, is deliberately biblical. In fact, Gopnik adds, it is difficult to find a single obviously classical reference in all of his speeches. In the Gettysburg Address, as Gopnik put it, quote, Lincoln had mastered the sound of the King James Bible so completely that he could recast abstract issues of constitutional law in biblical terms, making the proposition that Texas and New Hampshire should be forever bound by a single post office sound like something right out of Genesis. Thus, whether or not the Gettysburg Address's opening words were inspired by a sermon from a rabbi who had himself learned English by mastering the cadences of the King James Bible, the striking linguistic link allows us to appreciate, either way, that the Gettysburg Address is itself a sermon inspired by the Bible. The address is itself not meant to be Greek, but biblical, not a classical oration or philosophical deduction, but a prophetic proclamation. Indeed, one other much-discussed linguistic feature of the Gettysburg Address reflects this, and this is the second part of Lincoln's brief remarks, which says as follows, "We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we do this, but in the larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they here gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth." Now again, the phrase is that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom. There are 5 known copies of the Gettysburg Address in Lincoln's own hand. The first 2, written before or on the day of the address, do not contain the words "under God." You could see this in page 3 of your handout. This was from Lincoln's original draft, meaning the one which he wrote it out before the speech, known as the Nicolai copy, I believe, for Lincoln's secretary. The first page was written on stationery of the White House. The second page was just a plain piece of paper, as you see. And as you can see, I have a little arrow on the right. This is Lincoln's handwriting. He writes that this nation shall have a new birth of freedom. No, under God. The other 3 versions that we have, which was written after the Gettysburg Address was delivered, sent by Lincoln to those who requested it, do contain those words, "under God." So you have the next page, what's known as the Everett copy, requested by Edward Everett, the 2-hour-long speaker. I've circled the bottom left, you see. Again, Lincoln's handwriting. that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom. Meanwhile, the transcription of the press that were there on that day report the words under God as being in the speech. This would indicate, as my friend, the great Lincoln historian Harold Holzer has suggested, that Lincoln had not written the words under God in his original draft, but said them in the moment, inserted them in the moment, and then incorporated those words in his own version of the address that followed. Or as I would put it, caught as it were in the prophetic moment, he added the words under God on his own. For Lincoln, this is a biblical sermon. The blood of the battlefield is suddenly the blood of the covenant. They, the people gathered, cannot sanctify the fields because the soldier's blood has already sanctified the field. Sanctified it for America's central principle that all men are created equal. It is our obligation, for Lincoln, to those who died, to ensure that those whose blood was shed did not die in vain. In the end, Rabbi Sabato Moraes outlasted his critics, and in 1868, I'm pleased to report, was granted a lifetime contract from the synagogue. Wow. An inspiration to rabbis everywhere. But the story of his 17th of Tammuz sermon is largely forgotten. And if we put ourselves in Moraes' shoes, standing in the pulpit on that day, not knowing whether the Battle of Gettysburg was won or lost, we gain a renewed appreciation of the perilous nature of the moment. If you visit Gettysburg and learn about the battle, you will come to appreciate how easily it could have gone the other way. It could have been different. Lee did not march on Philadelphia, but he could have. He might have. And then the victory at Vicksburg might have mattered little. Thus, a new lesson can be derived from Moraes, one which also relates to the 17th of Tammuz. If you look in the Hebrew calendar for the year 1776, you will see that the first 4th of July also fell out on the 17th of Tammuz. Now, I was wondering if anyone else had noticed this aside from me. And so I Googled around, and I discovered, amusingly, the website known as JewInTheCity.com, which apparently takes questions and answers about Jewish tradition. And somebody wrote to him, I think he's a rabbi, "Dear Jew in the City, two people have told me that July 4th, 1776 was on the 17th of Tammuz. Wikipedia confirms this. Does that indicate something negative about America?" That's the question. He responds by listing several great rabbis born on the 17th of Tammuz. Doesn't mean something bad about them. And then he continues, "For that matter, we have a tradition that Mashiach, the Messiah, will be born on Tisha B'Av. Does that suggest something bad about Mashiach?" he said. Now, this is all true. But there is a deeper message, perhaps. If America, the nation conceived in liberty and inspired by the Bible, was born on the day that Jews mourned for destruction, and if the turning point, or a decisive point, of America, of the Union survival in the Civil War, also occurred on or around the 4th of July that was Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, then this is a reminder that the American experiment is fragile, so fragile, that it can so easily be lost, that it can too experience destruction in battle or just from failure to remain loyal to the true lessons of the American Creed. But we owe the Declaration's preservation to the past, to those who have come before. We are obligated, as Lincoln said, to ensure that these dead shall not have died in vain. The possible literary link between Moraes' recalling of Jerusalem and Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and the knowledge of the biblical themes or inspiration for Lincoln's words makes it all the more striking that it is the Jews of today's Judea and Jerusalem who in their own civic celebrations make manifest the lessons of Lincoln's words that we have to link independence and its celebration with the blood and the sacrifice of those who fought for that freedom, those whose blood obligates us. Interestingly, just as the Battle of Gettysburg concluded on July 3rd, the day before American Independence Day, Israelis since 1951 have held their own Memorial Day commemorations on the day before their Independence Day celebrations. So on the morning of the 4th of Iyar, a siren sounds throughout the land. Everyone pauses their everyday activity in reverent memory of those who have died. There are few more stunning images of Israel today than highways in which thousands of cars grind to a halt, and all travelers stand at the roadside and bow their heads in commemoration. Then throughout the day, cemeteries are visited. And only in the evening does the somber day of remembrance give way to the joy of the next day, Independence Day. If you speak to anyone who's experienced it, these 2 days define each other. Those assembled in Israel's cemeteries facing the unbearable loss of loved ones do so in the knowledge that it is the sacrifice of their family members that make the next day's celebration of independence possible. And the celebration of independence is begun with the acknowledgement by millions of citizens that those who lie in the cemeteries, who in Lincoln's words, gave their last full measure of devotion, obligate the living to ensure that the dead did not die in vain. Meanwhile, here in America, while we have a version of Memorial Day, and Memorial Day actually began as a means of decorating and honoring the graves of the Civil War dead, this holiday is for us unconnected to the 4th of July. The days are not defining of each other. Both holidays are observed by many, though not all Americans, merely as escapes from work. And very few ponder the link between the sacrifice of the American dead and the freedom that we, the living, enjoy. There is no denying, therefore, that the Israeli insistence on linking their Independence Day celebration with their Memorial Day observance is not only fitting, it is actually more American. It is a truer fulfillment of Lincoln's message at Gettysburg. The joining of Shiva Asar B'Tammuz and the 4th of July in 1776 and 47 years later in Moraes' post-Gettysburg sermon of 1863 is a reminder that Gettysburg and America's birth must always be joined in our minds and linked in our civic observance. It is, of course, unlikely that Memorial Day will be moved to the 3rd of July. But that should not prevent us from learning from the Israeli example and from the lessons of Lincoln's address. Imagine if the 3rd of July was dedicated to remembering that battle, the battle that occurred on that date. Call it Gettysburg Day. Imagine if Gettysburg Day involved a brief moment of commemoration by us, the living, for those who gave the last full measure of devotion. Imagine if tens or hundreds of millions of Americans paused in unison from their leisurely summer activities for a minute or two in order to reflect on the sacrifice of generations past. Surely our observance of the Independence Day that followed the day after could not fail to be affected. Surely the 4th of July would be marked in a manner more worthy of a great nation. Surely this would be more true to the extraordinary legacy that Lincoln has left us. Thank you very much. Thank you.